Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest this week is Terry Adams of NRBQ. The new reissue that we're here to talk about is from Skeeter Davis and NRBQ called She Sings, They Play. It looks great. It sounds great. It's got a bunch of bonus tracks, and we'll get deep into it in just a moment. Let me just remind you first that if you are an NRBQ fan or looking for some more information about the band, we've done lots of interviews with folks, members of the band. They're all over at wfmu.org/Michael. I've talked to Joey and Johnny Spampinato, to Casey, Scott, and John, who are in the current lineup of NRBQ, to Tom, the original drummer of the band, and to Don, Terry's brother. There's also a great live set from NRBQ, all there at wfmu.org/Michael. Also, Terry, in December 2016, was in the studio in person. That's just when that last box set came out, so it was a good time for a chat about the retrospective of the band's history and to play a bunch of tracks. So don't miss that. All of those archives over at wfmu.org/Michael. All right, now here it is, me and Terry Adams chatting about Skeeter Davis and NRBQ, She Sings, They Play. All right, there is the brand new re-release from NRBQ. Actually, it's titled Skeeter Davis and NRBQ, She Sings, They Play. And Terry Adams joins us on the phone. Good morning, Terry. How you doing?
Okay, I'm doing good.
So happy you guys sent me this new record. It's just lovely. I mean, I have the album, but hearing this new reissue with all the bonus tracks and sounds great, looks great. How you feel about it?
Oh, I'm happy with it. It sounds real good to me, too.
Yeah.
Good memories, good songs, you know, it feels good. That's all.
Yeah. I read, now there's some great liner notes by world-renowned NRBQ expert Johnny D, and he talks a little bit about how you sort of had this fascination with the Davis sisters, Skeeter's first recordings, way back, is it in your childhood?
Yeah, back, I think I was 4 or something, and the record just did something to me. And I don't know what it was, but then it didn't make me feel like any other record that was around. And it just stuck with me. Eventually, I came across some more stuff of theirs and got really hooked on them. And it's just magic music. She's got a sense of harmony that's not like anyone else.
She must have been really young herself making those records. And I agree with you. There's something weird, not weird, but unusual about the way those two ladies harmonized.
Yeah, that's right. It's very strange, you know, and it just does something to me. Any of them, even not even the best ones, are still doing something to me. It's really something.
She had quite the career. You know, after that, she made records in Nashville, you know, with all those cream of the Nashville crop guys produced by Chet Atkins. So what was her state of her career in, you know, when you guys recorded this record? Was she kind of playing the oldies circuit? Was she, what was she doing?
I'm not sure, but she was off of RCA, I think.
So had you had this idea like, hey, I'd like to make a record with her? It just seemed like a good idea, just that simple?
Well, you know, in the late 70s, we invented our own label called Red Rooster, and I had some things I wanted to do on it, so I wanted to talk to her about the Davis sisters. I got to first let me back up and tell you that sometime in 73, you know, before Tom joined the band, we were friends, and he called me and said, hey, guess what? Skeeter Davis is playing at the amusement park up here that next day. So I got in my car and drove up to it, and I showed her the 45s and kind of really got her, I think, because I had every Davis sister record there ever was at that point, all the RCAs and Fortune records and all that, and I had them all together. So she was moved by it, and we had a nice talk, and then we both jumped on the roller coaster. I mean, a real roller coaster. You know, rode the roller coaster around, and so we stayed in touch. You know, she'd write letters and stuff like that. And eventually, I came around to the Red Rooster thing and thinking, man, I'd love to put that album out, put an album out of a collection of their stuff. So that's what we were talking about. We didn't know we were going to make a new record at that point.
Gotcha. Was NRBQ on her radar? Did she know who you guys were, like, when you first met her?
No, but she's, you know, somewhere in the middle there. I must have given her a couple of records, or she picked up a couple, because she already had favorites when we did get in the studio. So that's all I know.
So the idea to record the records recorded in Rhode Island, which is, I don't know, I never heard of a record made in Rhode Island. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of records made in Rhode Island, but I just never heard of one. So how did that come to be?
There was some studio up there that just was putting itself together. So they had the wires all over the place and microphones, you know, just like crazy. But that gave us a good deal, you know, it was really cheap. They wanted to try it out. So we went up there and got a good sound like that. And we were with Tom Mark, our you know, great engineer we were working with.
Yeah.
So that's how that started.
I noticed that on this record there's a picture of you playing what I guess is a harpsichord, and that's what it says in the credits. Was there just a harpsichord lying around that studio, or did you bring it up there?
You're very bright to know what a harpsichord is. Yeah, that's what it is. No, I rented. I was trying to rent one, and I guess I rejected one, and then got another one in from Boston, I guess, and because I had a special song for it, so I needed it.
So, how long to make this record? And did you guys rehearse, or did you just meet up in the studio and just start working?
You know, we had a little session somewhere at Carla Bley's studio, just to see what it would be like, and ran over 4 or 5 songs and thought we were going to do good. So we took a few months and got, I don't know how long, but anyway, we booked time and got on the session in 81.
And then, so how long once the red light went, like a couple days or a week, or how long did it take?
That's a good question. You know, I'd say 3 or 4 days, 4 days maybe. You know, one of the songs I had in mind was Someday My Prince Will Come. And I had some guy in mind to play pedal steel, but she said no, that Buddy Emmons could handle it. So I remember him coming up and doing that song with us. And I guess we used him on some other songs while we had him. I remember that being something we did up there. He was great.
Yeah, he goes back to, like, Ernest Tubb, to the 1950s. He obviously is a huge pro. Was he, you know, happy working the way you guys work?
Yeah, I mean, he, as long as, you know, he didn't mind flying up and working there, you know. He just turned out to be really good on that song, I thought.
Yeah, he's great. So the same question about Skeeter. Like I said, she made all these records in Nashville with Chet Atkins, and they have, like, a very specific way of working down there, you know, in these, like, 3-hour chunks, and I don't think they smile much. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But that's how I imagine. They're just looking at their charts and, you know, tossing. I mean, they're great records. But was she happy to, like, oh, this is a little bit more of a relaxed thing? We're just kind of working it up together. Was she happy to be part of that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I went to see her, when we got off of the Davis Sisters subject, we switched to, what if we did something live? So that's when, you know, our brains started going, and she had a few songs that were possible, and I mentioned Someday My Prince Will Come and Don't Know What I Got to Lose It. I mentioned those songs, and so anyway, we had some in our heads before we got in the studio, and they worked out good. I mean, she had Temporarily Out of Order and Everybody Wants a Cowboy and some things going on, so it was very relaxed. We just you know, did it till it was good, you know.
Yeah.
Good take.
Yeah, you mentioned Steve Ferguson's You Don't Know What You Got Till You Lose It. What a fantastic song that is. And I don't know, did he ever record that, or did he just show that to you? I don't know where it's from.
I don't know about him recording it, but, you know, that's a song we had been doing for a long time. So, you know, 70s, I guess, we were doing that song with him, and then we kept on doing it after he left. Al sang it. It was called Don't Know What I've Got Till I Lose It. You know, she didn't want to be the drinking one, so switched it around.
Oh, that's great. And you guys still do it now, and it still kills. Yeah, there's some great, great songs on this. Things to You, which you guys did on All Hopped Up. What? I mean, that's one of my favorite songs. Just since you wrote that one, I mean, I know it's a long time ago. Do you remember writing that song?
Yeah, I did. And I don't know what to tell you about it, but just at the piano, singing, you know, the melody is very simple. I don't know. You sing one note over and over, and then finally we raise up the note one more, and then solo goes down a half step, and you just keep pounding on the note. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, that song has, like, a great way that it kind of resolves at the end. There's a, I don't know, you know, it's, I think as a songwriter, it's hard to come up with new ways to kind of say the same emotions or communicate these ideas, you know, and so it's always impressive, I think, when a simple song like that manages to say it in a new way that maybe people didn't think of. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah.
How many tears? Did you write that just for her?
I did. I don't know. It doesn't happen very often, but that's, you know, it just came in my mind. And she liked it, so had to get that harp scored.
I should mention that the original album has 12 tracks. This new reissue on Omnivore's got 18 tracks, a bunch of bonus tracks. It's got a nice booklet. It's all got some new pictures on the outside and in the inside of the book. And one of the bonus tracks is a version of I Want You Bad. Was this recorded during the session and considered for inclusion on the original release?
It was. You know, it was her idea, too. I was surprised to hear her say it.
Huh.
And we did it, and it didn't get on there for one reason or another. The harmonies or whatever reason, we just passed on it eventually. I think it was a mistake. You know, it's a great song. By the way, about a year before that happened, Dinya Raven and Ronnie Spector came up to us, and she said, I'd really like a verse written for me for I Want You Bad. So they were, you know, girls wanting to sing it too. Kind of crazy, huh?
Oh, that makes kind of makes sense, though, right? Everybody can relate to that. Yeah, it's a great version. I mean, when I first heard it, my mind was mildly blown. Like, it was just such a fresh idea, you know, it just kind of popped out. Yeah, I think you're right.
It probably
should have been on there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The other one that's on there is that Wanda Jackson tune, I Gotta Know. Again, it's just great. It's got these tempo changes, and it kind of fits perfectly in with what you guys were so great at. Just didn't feel it should have been on the record?
Well, that one was more just something to do. It wasn't as special to us.
Hmm.
But it does sound good.
Yeah, it's a fun one. And then the other bonus tracks are some live tracks from a Bottom Line show you guys did. So that answers one of my questions. Did you guys play live? You obviously did at least one gig live. Did you do more than that, or was that just like a record release thing?
We actually did a lot more. And that recording is probably the night that record came out. And we probably had just seen it for the first time, and she was there. And so we did it. And we were starting to do it a lot of places. By that time, she was with Joey in 85. So she was around us a lot more on the road. And so when the record had just came out, so it was a good for her to get up there and surprise the audience and do her some of the stuff in the record. Not always the same songs, but we did them. So, yeah, there's a lot more.
So when you made a record like this, I mean, maybe this didn't occur to you at the time, but did you have expectations of, you know, who would listen to this or who would, did you think it was going to do, you know, sell a million copies, or did you think country folks would like it, or NRBQ people, or a little of everybody? Did you even think about that stuff?
Every record we ever put out, we thought should be a million copies sold. So it's another one. That's what we're thinking. This is going to be huge.
Yeah, good. That's the right. That's the right attitude. I agree.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, they should be. Well, now's another chance, right? So here it is again. There's a part in the liner notes where Skeeter talks about how she felt about the project, and you can tell that she felt it was real special. And I saw her once sing at the Grand Ole Opry. She sang Silver Threads and Gold Needles. And she's just a very unusual lady. And I just mean that in the nicest way. She just comes across like a sweetheart and, you know, unusually talented. And I think going, being in show business since you were a little kid and going through the Nashville, you know, she made those great pop records in the kind of late mid-60s. I mean, what a career, you know. And then this, and then she ended up, you know, marrying Joey. You tell me, how do you describe how she felt about how the record came out and how the whole project affected her life?
Well, she loved it. And I'll just say that she has her own voice and her own way of presenting it. I mean, I could say that about a lot of women. But something about her harmonies and her voice, I don't know, it's just really different, I think. Very honest, you know. I liked her singing on the record, and I liked the song she wrote. Got a good sense of humor, too.
Yeah, John Travolta.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. There's like a vulnerability to her that you don't hear in every singer.
Right, and I like it when she imitates herself. You know, at the end of that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, kind of a weird thing to do. I can sing like me and then sing a little off. That's three levels in, right?
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah, it's great. So you guys have been working with Omnivore, I don't know, about the past 5 years or so. I don't know, something like that. And reissuing all these records, they all sound real good. They all look real good. Is it a lot of work putting these together, or are you doing this? Is someone else doing the work?
Well, I mean, there a lot of them are reissues, and you just recommend some. Who's doing the mastering? You just recommend what it needs over what it used to be. Yeah, you can tell. You know, after all those years, I can hear, you know, listen to our first album. I know it's an inspired, crazy record, but then you know what can make it better, you know, turn up the bass on this song, et cetera. So, just some advice to mastering is all.
I was thinking about the record is just about 40 years old, but I was thinking when you made the record in 81, when you recorded it, 40 years would have been 1941. Which, you know, great records in 1941, but it's amazing how time has, I don't know, time has changed sort of. Like, this doesn't sound like the way a 1941 record sounded to us in 1981. That makes sense?
It's weird. I thought of that. I thought of that a lot when I was a kid, too, because, you know, you're buying coasters and Blink Ray and Elvis, Jerry Lee, and all this good stuff. And then a few years later, you say, oh, 10 years went by. And like, even if you go 10 years before that, it's Glenn Miller swinging. You know, I mean, not Glenn Miller, but, you know, it's just a whole other world with clarinets and no electric guitars up front. That's a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. And the way drums are just the, you know, so loud on every record now. That's just, yeah, that just didn't happen back then. Yeah, but it's, so I guess my point is that it's still real fresh sounding record.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I think so too.
Yeah. All right. What's your favorite track on the whole record? Is it something we've talked about?
I like Ain't Nice to Talk Like That. And May You Never Be Alone was really important to me. On that one, we were in the middle of the record, you know, just riding around. And I had, a record by, I was listening to Jack Scott. Remember Jack Scott? Burning Bridges. He had a lot of hits. Anyway, he had an album where he was singing Hank Williams. So May You Never Be Alone, like she said, oh, no, I love this song. And so she wanted to record it right away. And I said, okay, you know, so it's like a really deep Hank Williams song. You know, he really hits some spots in your heart. That writing is so good. So, you know, through Jack Scott we wound up with it, and it's just great. And I was producing it. I was a good enough producer to know not to play on it. I didn't want no keyboard on that record. So I guess that's a weird thing to say, but that's what happened. It was just so good.
All right, well, let's hear that one now, Terry Adams. Once again, the record is called She Sings, They Play, Skeeter Davis and NRBQ, just out just now on Omnivore. And folks can go to NRBQ.com and see where you guys are playing, buy some stuff, and just check out the NRBQ world.
All right, that's a good idea.
Thank you, Terry.
Okay, bye, Michael.
Like a bird that's lost its maiden flight, I'm alone and oh so blue tonight. Like a piece of driftwood on the sea, may you never be alone like me. Set me.